This is an ABC podcast.
Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Hello and welcome to the Pop Test, a quiz about science. I am Andy Matthews, the left wing of the supersonic passenger jet that is our hosting team.
And I am the oblivious goose being sucked into the hosting team's jet engine, yet somehow surviving and going on to write a best-selling book, later optioned as a film where I end up being played by Tom Hanks, Alistair Tremblay-Burchell. And today's episode is about agriculture. Andy, what is agriculture?
Agriculture, or as some would call it, applied gardening, is the gentle art of dirt enhancement. If you want to imagine it, an immersive 3D virtual reality version of a farming simulator. Without agriculture, we wouldn't have the cotton in our socks, the egg in our pocket, or the chemical runoff in our river systems.
And although food is historically one of the world's best-tasting things, many of the ingredients that go into growing it are a bit less palatable, including exploitation, environmental degradation, and inequality, not to mention Australian bush poetry. And many of these blights are still with us today.
And speaking of us, it's time for us to introduce our guests.
Our first guest is comedian, actor, and writer, Alice Fraser. Alice, have you got a favorite crop?
Oh, I think maize is my favorite crop, just because it's always the export of some place.
And maize is such a better word than corn, right?
Mm.
Corn is upsetting and depressing and like 90% of the American diet, whereas maize sounds mystical and delicious.
Yeah, and corn is also a synonym for like a growth on your foot.
Whereas maize sounds like a place where you might encounter a minotaur.
Exactly.
You know, and do battle, have some kind of legendary experience.
And our second guest is a soil scientist and lecturer in environmental chemistry at RMIT, Dr. Samantha Grover. Sam, what is better, dirt or rocks?
Oh, soil is so much better than rocks. People often think that when I say that I'm a soil scientist, that I'm a geologist.
Oh, no.
But no.
How offensive. Do you have a rivalry with geologists?
No, I think geologists are just much more well-known than soil scientists, but they tend to just scrape away the soil. They call it regolith, and they're only interested in the rocks underneath.
So what you're saying is you consider rocks to be beneath you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm glad.
And our final guest is comedian and bon vivant, Angus Gordon. Angus, you ever farmed?
No, but Centrelink is really trying to make me. They send me an email, do you want to go to a harvesting expo online? Absolutely not.
And remember, like a bunch of Clydesdales ploughing a turnip field, you're all on the same team. So let's heave together with our powerful horse brains and find out where this all began in the history round.
Something like 200,000 years ago, humans emerged and pursued a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And when they caught that lifestyle, they brought it back to their family to eat it with some berries. Hunter-gatherers were largely foragers, which, appropriately, they did forages. About 90% of human history, actually. But Alice,
yes.
How could living surrounded by garbage help you to make friends?
I mean, I'm assuming in this scenario it's sort of a giant tip and I'm the rat king.
Absolutely, if that's the scenario that works for you best.
Mm.
Yes, well, in that case, everyone wants to be friends with the rat king.
That's very close to the answer we have.
I think it also helps, you know, surrounded by garbage. It helps to prove that you're not unattainable, you know, and spending a lot
like
of time.
I'm not like other girls. I have a banana peel on my head.
Despite the smell, it makes you way more approachable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we were, of course, talking about dogs. Dogs are widely agreed to be the first domesticated animal, evolving from wolves around 30,000 years ago. Wolves were attracted to the garbage left by human tribes, and those that weren't aggressive were more likely to be allowed near, eventually becoming hunting companions of humans, and ultimately a beast of burden, the burden of our pathetic need to be loved unconditionally. Like most domesticated animals, dogs have fewer of a thing called neural crest stem cells than their wild counterparts, which tends to make them smaller and less aggressive.
Also, if you live in filth, Department of Human Services will get involved, and then they'll send you a social worker. They're not your friend.
No,
but you can talk to them.
They're like a government friend.
And over time, they'll become domesticated towards you. You can throw them balls.
Mm. A side effect of having dogs around is that your tribe doesn't have to move around so much because they protect you from predators, and sometimes they just lie down on the footpath and refuse to move for no reason. And when you spend a season or two in the same place, you might notice that plants growing from the seeds of plants that you harvested the year before. And since this point in history, Angus, humans have been enslaved by what?
I think I read in that book, Sapiens, that it was like grain or wheat, but that feels like a very liberal use of the words enslaved. And there's no form of slavery where you get to also eat the master. Do you mean that's not slavery? That's something else. That's a very weird niche thing that maybe a few guys in Germany are into, but most of us don't consider that slavery. You know what I mean? Slavery is a big issue. It's still happening. Mm. But you can't turn around to that person and go like, well, in a way, we're all enslaved by wheat. So what you do is the same as what I do. So it's all, you know, much of a muchness.
Yeah.
Feel free to jump in at any time and just be like, no, it is aliens, you idiot. And this is how we find out. And then your skin starts dissolving and reveals your horrible tentacle mess of a form. And then we do the rest of the quiz as normal.
You know what? You were correct when you said wheat, so I'm going to give you the point. Wheat, or perhaps wheat, rice, and potatoes.
But I disagree with the question.
No, I don't want the point. I said that was wrong.
Take it away from me. Dissolve the quiz. Have a good hard look at yourselves when you're writing these questions down.
That was the pop test, and see you next week.
Wheat, or perhaps wheat, rice, and potatoes, or at least according to Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, who reckons the entirety of agricultural history has been a fraud. Humans work harder and are less well off than they were as hunter-gatherers, planting, feeding, and watering this bloody grass as we help it to expand all over the globe. Harari reckons humans were domesticated by wheat, and it's interesting to note that humans also have low levels of neural crest stem cells. However you look at it, around 11,000 years ago, we started cultivating plants and agriculture began.
Whoa.
And now we're all just zombies wandering the earth going, grains. Come on.
No, that was good.
Keto is the only way to break our chains.
Yeah. Right. So gluten intolerance is a form of revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this development happened all over the world in a similar time frame. And in Europe, people realized that the creatures they hunted were all vegetarians and that they could feed them with the grain and seeds that they had already stored. For example, horses, which people ate for years before realizing that they could ride them, which to me makes me think that there may be some foods that we eat now that we may one day realize that we can ride. Sandwich, I'm looking at you as a good contender. But Samantha, how did ancient diarrhea help modern Europeans?
Now, look, I think that's a tricky question. Definitely, ancient agricultural practices were much better at recycling nutrients. So diarrhea and all other forms of human waste were returned to the fields where the food had been grown, which is a really sensible and important thing that we've forgotten how to do.
Yeah, I mean, that is an absolutely great answer and probably even better than the one that we have.
I'll do yours as well.
But I say, you know, you wouldn't accept somebody putting manure on your food after you eat it. So why is it different before it's even grown? It feels like a double
microbes.
Standard.
Microbes.
Microbes, tell me more.
Microbes are our friends because they transform that waste, human waste or the garbage tip waste that Alice is the queen of.
Thank you.
They break it down and they transform it into nutrients that plants need.
The answer that we have is that diarrhea helped in the long run because it's thought that Apologies, I didn't even realize. Diarrhea helped in the long run because it's thought that as people moved into colder areas of Europe, it was harder to make cheese and yogurt from milk of their cows, a process needed to remove the lactose that most adult humans couldn't digest at the time. In times of famine, the sick and frail would be forced to drink fresh milk, and those with mutations allowing them to digest lactose would be the ones who didn't die of diarrhea, leading to an evolution of certain Europeans, African, and Middle Eastern populations who can digest milk.
But agriculture cannot happen in a vacuum. For one thing, the cows keep exploding. For another, technological advancements happen all the time. When the Romans went invading around the Mediterranean, they would happily steal any good agricultural ideas for their agriculture manuals, a kind of agricultural appropriation. And good ideas quickly spread. But, Alice, what is the most useful item if you hope to restart civilization after an apocalypse?
Let's say a plow. Why not?
Alice, why not? Well, because I can't think of a reason why not. You are absolutely correct.
Because tillage is outdated and is exposing our soil carbon to microbes, and it's... Well, we need to use less of the plough. Sorry,
we did say that we wanted to rebuild civilization, you know,
exactly.
but not build a totally new and better civilization.
Okay.
We're just trying to get back into the same old nightmare that got us into this mess in the first place.
But wait, are you saying that these days there's another bit of thinking on ploughs?
Like, look, I really loved how Andy started the show around saying that agriculture was about doing something nice to soil. There was something in your opening.
The gentle art of soil enhancement.
Soil enhancement!
Mm. But ploughing, you say, takes good stuff out of the soil.
That was so beautiful. And that is actually revolutionary because we've been degrading our soils with our agricultural practices.
I am a revolutionary.
Certainly since we arrived in Australia bringing European practices.
Mm. But is there an alternative to the plough?
Absolutely.
Now?
Absolutely. Yeah. Soil enhancement. It's called regenerative agriculture, or in Europe, it's called agroecology.
According to science historian James Burke, the answer is the plough, with some dissenting opinions. But with the advent of the Iron Age, the most significant agricultural implement in human history, the iron plough was perfected. First arising in China over 2,000 years ago, they revolutionized European agriculture, allowing the efficient tilling of dense clay soil, increasing productivity, and allowing the creation of leisure, but also inequality, sexual oppression, and armies.
So I knew it had to be either, because it's the Romans, right? It had to be either the plough or the tortoise, right?
that's all they've ever done.
Which is their defensive shield configuration. Those are the two things I know about the Romans.
I thought that was what they were using to pull the plough.
But to a certain extent, agriculture to this point had progressed through trial and its clumsy comedy duo partner, error. But agricultural science began to develop when in the 1860s, Augustinian monk Gregor Mendel worked out the mathematical rules of genetic inheritance. Rules that became extremely relevant in the 20th century as population growth exploded and the world became paranoid about food security. But Samantha, if you suddenly had to provide food for 1 billion people, what would you do?
Now, that is one of the questions that we did some homework on this morning with my son. And we decided that we would, if we were in a new place and we had to feed 1 billion people, we would ask the locals for advice.
Yeah.
Do they know somewhere good where you can go, where you can get a booking at short notice?
Yeah.
Maybe
exactly.
With some outdoor seating. You say that the locals have some wisdom.
Because they know the local conditions.
Mm.
The local plants have evolved with the local soils and climate.
Mm.
And so although they might look strange and unfamiliar and you would never imagine eating them when you first arrive in a place, you know, when you go to Mexico, oh, maize, it's amazing.
Mm. Mm.
And I think there's some really amazing Australian foods too that we haven't really grasped yet because we forgot to ask the locals when we got here.
If there was one Australian food that you could tell people to eat right now, what would it be?
Kangaroo.
Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Well, the answer that we have is really far from that. we would invent stem rust-resistant semi-dwarf wheat, of course.
Oh, not that semi-dwarf wheat. That is the bane. Sorry.
That is one of the problems.
I know nothing about plant breeding, but I think it's been really successful and really important. But
of course,
it's been really focused on human needs.
Mm.
It's been really focused on the grain or the part that we particularly value. And we've forgotten about the whole ecosystem. So we've actually bred, you know, these dwarf species,
mm-hmm.
which means then we're not returning enough stubble or, you know, the straw into the soil. And we've bred away roots. But as the climate becomes more variable and your plants have like been bred out of having roots, then they're much more delicate.
This solution, presented in the middle of last century by American agronomist Norman Borlaug, who, by careful hybridization of wheat varieties, developed a plant that increased crop yields by a factor of 10. It led to Mexico, Pakistan, and India going from facing famine to becoming self-sufficient in food. And in the sure sign of a great invention, it was co-opted by the U.S. military as a weapon against communism.
One of the consequences of Borlaug's success, which won him the Nobel Peace Prize, was a growth in huge farms growing monocultures, a single varieties of a single crop. But he saw this as necessary to tackle what he called the population monster. He also thought that it had only brought us time and we would need more solutions in the long run, including genetically modified foods, a prediction that became a reality in the 1990s when Calgene started selling the first genetically modified crop, the Flavor Saver tomato. But Angus, what disastrous unforeseen problem forced them out of business?
It wasn't a very nice flavour.
Mm.
Like, it really stayed on the tongue, but it was like dead ant.
It's all very well to save a flavour, but, you know, some Some people, you don't want them.
Yeah, drove people mad. They were cutting out their tongues. They couldn't call up and say what the problem was.
Yeah.
This was before email was really popular as well. So like you had to write a letter saying the flavor is unbearable. I've been driven mad by the taste of ant.
Yeah.
More and more people have already got that flavor stuck in their brain.
It's too late.
I'm only joking, of course. It was because the Flavor Saver tomato obviously enslaved us.
It's short for Flavor Slaver.
I still worship the Flavor Saver tomato overlords. Thank you very much.
You're incredibly close, but unfortunately, in this case, it was that they cost five times more to make than they were selling them for. Despite being genetically modified to allow them to ripen on the vine and last longer on the shelf, unlike most tomatoes that are picked green and artificially ripened with ethylene gas, it turns out a genetics company didn't necessarily have what it took to make it in the cutthroat world of commercial tomato farming. Some say that the failure of the Flavor Saver meant that researchers moved away from marketing GMOs as a positive thing for consumers and towards the benefits to farmers of using more herbicides and pesticides and increasing profits, which led to consumers only hearing about genetic modification in the context of putting more chemicals on the food that they eat and souring our views towards GM. Which brings us to the end of round one. And at the end of round one, Team Science, you are on 4 points, which means that it's wide open.
RN, online.
The dot there.
The pop test.
And now on to round two. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but we are happy to pretend that our guests do by asking them to give us their best guess. And then we will correct them because we have all the answers. This round is called How Do Whales Work?
So, Alice,
yes.
How, in your opinion, could not having enough bird poo add years to World War One?
Well, obviously, because having enough bird poo is incredibly important to the Germans and their Prussian identity. And if you don't have enough bird poo, then their morale collapses. Or what about if you don't have enough bird poo, things just go on and on? Come on.
You gwanna do what you gwanna do. Unfortunately, the correct answer is that it forces you to invent the Haber-Bosch process, of course. At the turn of the 19th century, global food production was propped up by trade in guano, which is made almost entirely of nitrogen, phosphate and potassium, the three most important macronutrients for plants. Plus, thanks to the social habits of the birds that produce it, it tends to be available in huge concentrated heaps. But as with everything that is pure, like huge piles of bird feces, we managed to ruin it with exploitative and destructive practices that obliterated global supplies, leaving things looking pretty grim until two German scientists found a way to fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere into ammonia for use in synthetic fertilizers. Good news, except this new process produces massive amounts of carbon dioxide, and being able to produce ammonia for explosives probably extended the First World War by years.
Now, Sam, say you managed to get your hands on 320 gigaliters of human excrement. In a perfect world, with every option available at your fingertips, what would you think is the best thing to do with it?
Without a doubt, I would apply it to the soil, but not to the surface. I would use it for subsoil manuring.
Whoa.
How do you get down there? Yeah. Moles? You train moles?
Is it like
Please tell me it's trained moles.
Oh, I like that. Do you think we can import moles and train them? Maybe wombats might be more appropriate in Australia. In fact, there's a kind of plough which has been specifically developed for subsoil manuring.
For wombats to pull underground? Wombats.
Actually pulled by a traditional kind of tractor, but
sure. Well, I would say that you are absolutely correct. That is the right answer. This is the amount of sewage that is produced by Melbourne in a year, 320 gigaliters, and it should be exploited for its phosphorus, because unlike nitrogen, there is no way to get it from the air. This means that farms essentially export phosphorus from the soil, shipping it off to become proto-sewage, or as some call it, food. To replace it, we depend on phosphate mining. But ideally, we would get it all back via sewage treatment, including the beautifully named activated sludge process, and reuse it later as fertilizer.
I hope our urban planning ministers are listening.
They all are, yes.
We're having a listening party for only them.
And finally, Angus, how would you approach the challenge of creating food without using plants, animals, or fungi, which we consider to be a crutch?
Yeah, it's tough because that's sort of the basis of most of my diet. It'd be like one of those real tough mystery challenges on a cooking show. maybe like sulfur fixing bacteria or bacteria that can fix sunlight. Like, is algae a plant? Anyway, I would do that. Normally, I don't eat bacteria. I try and destroy it from my cooking surfaces. But then I've heard about good bacteria. Yeah. Maybe I make like a drink from the sulfur of bacteria.
Yes.
And then I'll drink that.
Are you just talking about drinkable yogurt?
Yeah, but I didn't want to say the brand name one. Obviously, I don't know which bacteria is good to eat or bad to eat or algae. I don't know. I know some you can't eat.
Yeah.
I can either get funding to like do pretty unethical experiments or Google it.
Find a bacteria, put it on the tip of your finger, put it on the tongue, wait a couple of 15 minutes.
But if it's bad, what if I put it on someone else's tongue? That's what I like the bit of, and then sure. I see what happens to them.
You've got to get ethics approval. That'll take years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like your first idea of the cooking show, because I think it's too easy for them. Every time when they, on Iron Chef, they reveal that ingredient, it's always something edible, isn't it? One time, I'd like it to be actual iron, see what you can do with this.
Yeah, or like a polo shirt.
Yeah.
Angus, I'm going to give you the points. A new food has been created by researchers in Finland using only air, water, and electricity. They harnessed bacteria to convert carbon dioxide into protein and made it into a powder that can be used as food or animal feed. And by using solar power as the source of electricity, the process can be nearly 10 times as energy efficient as commoners' muck photosynthesis, emission-free, use much less land than traditional agriculture, and be made entirely within solar panel-covered shipping containers. The rural ideal. Row after row of shipping containers.
Do you think the farmers still wear akubras as they go through their underground layers?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you imagine the bush poetry that it inspires? Mm. Do you want to have a little verse, Andy?
We'll all be ruined, said Hanrahan, in accents most forlorn. Outside the shipping container, ere mass began, one indescribable moment of the day or night. Oh my God, absolutely on
and,
the spot.
And at the end of that round, Team Science is on 9 points, which means you guys can still win this.
Oh, yes.
RN, the pop test.
Finally, it's time to saddle up your fastest sandwich as we gallop towards the end of the show in the velocity round. Question one, what pesticides can be used in organic farming? And just a hint, this isn't a trick question.
Sam, ladybirds.
Oh, very good.
Insects that eat pest insects, ladybirds.
Well, that is a beautiful answer and correct.
How many squirts in a litre of milk? Angus.
Depends on the cow, depends on how you squirt it.
Give us a range.
The way I do it, it's just one squirt,
one big
liter.
Squirt. You grab the udder from the top.
From the top.
This is your revolutionary technique.
And I massage very slowly and I bring all the teats together.
Yeah.
And then one long, powerful tender at the same time pull liter.
It takes just as long, but it's immensely more satisfying for the cow.
Longer, if anything, but they prefer it.
The correct answer was about 90.
Why are kiwi fruits called kiwi fruits?
Alice.
Yes, Alice.
Because that's what happens if you cut open a kiwi bird. It's full of little green bits and seeds.
Absolutely, very close. It's like that animal that you feed coffee beans to, and it creates those,
civets.
Coffee beans in poop. This one.
New Zealanders don't want you to know this, but that's where they all come from.
You feed coffee beans to their birds, and you get kiwi fruits. Very close. They originated in China, but as Chinese gooseberries, and then they were imported to New Zealand, where they started calling them kiwi fruits because they looked like a kiwi bird. So you're actually really close.
Oh, that's interesting. Avocados used to be called crocodile pears or something. Alligator pears, that's what they were called.
And then they managed to breed them so that they didn't, they didn't attack on sight. And, now they're on every breakfast.
What are the four things a combine harvester combines?
Angus.
Yes.
Tractor. Football combine. Bush poetry.
Yeah.
The spirit of human ingenuity.
When we finally got that first machine that could do the poetry for you, that cut down the number of employees required for a farm by 50%.
The productivity gains were incredible.
Unfortunately, the answer is reaping, threshing, gathering, and my personal favorite, winnowing. What does a stump jump plow do?
Angus, yes. It's a 90 euros dance craze.
Very close. It was an Australian invention that allowed mallee farmers to plow their fields even though they were filled with the hard and difficult to remove mallee root.
Ironic that the mallee roots aren't malleable.
There's the iron plow and then there's the ironic plow for getting out the mallee roots. Which brings us to the end of the show. And Team Science, you are on 13 points, which means you win. Congratulations.
Yay!
Thanks to our guests, Sam Grover, Angus Gordon and Alice Fraser. Thank you for listening. And until next time, remember,
I wear the pants in my relationship. My wife wears the trench coat and buys the movie tickets. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.